Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, Adams versus City of Indianapolis, Mr. Gadsden.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Gregory Gadsden, and I represent the appellants in Adams versus City of Indianapolis. I have just a few brief things I'd like to say, and then I know the Seventh Circuit is famous for grilling the attorneys, and I know it's always towards getting at justice. So after that, let the grilling begin. It's true that the appeal we have today is about our case only, but I believe we have raised some issues about pleading practice that have not really been resolved within this circuit or elsewhere. And one of the issues is with respect to motions to dismiss and motions for judgment on the pleadings, is it appropriate to use summary judgment cases? And do plaintiffs need to make out prima facie cases in order to survive those type of motions? Now, I think what has been happening over the years is courts and attorneys have been sleepwalking towards this de facto standard, but we believe that standard is incompatible with the Rule 8 and the notice pleading system that we have. The Supreme Court certainly hasn't said that you need a prima facie case in order to have an adequate complaint. You're well aware of the Belinanti versus Twombly decisions and the Iqbal decisions. But those only require that you raise your complaint above the level of speculation and that they be plausible on its face. So there are a number of practices that were carried out in this case and other courts, quite frankly. And we believe this is a good time for the circuit to look at these pleading practices and perhaps decide when, one way or another, what is acceptable in those. The defendants, unfortunately, they have, for most of these arguments, they've cited no cases. They can't cite any real bedrock principles in our system as to why we need to follow those standards. This case started out as a discrimination case, it is a discrimination case, and the main components of the case were disparate treatment claims and disparate impact claims.
And so let's start there. Where in the complaint is there an allegation that the promotion process is facially neutral? To my way of thinking, that is necessary to find that a disparate impact discrimination was properly pled. Where can we find that in the court?
Well, Judge Williams, that's exactly the problem, isn't it? What you're stating is what you have to show on summary judgment. But let's talk about the notice pleading requirement. Basically, there are three aspects of notice pleading, I think, that we all have to remember. I think when a defendant receives a lawsuit, first he needs to, or she, they have to have fair notice of why they're being sued. They have to have a fair opportunity to be able to prepare a defense. And they deserve a right to be free from truly unmeritorious lawsuits. But as we've argued in our brief, the idea that you have to meet summary judgment requirements is more akin to code pleading and fact pleading systems. And now when we adopted the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure back under the Rules Enabling Act in 1934, partially it was to get away from those technical pleading requirements that you saw where you had to have a demurrer and all these other elements that we've done away with. And Rule 8, quite simply, doesn't say that you have to plead a cause of action. It says you have to plead a claim for which relief can be granted. I'm paraphrasing.
So your position would be that you don't have to allege a facially neutral employment policy?
I believe I have two answers to that. One, I think we've already done so. And the problem I have with this approach is We shouldn't need to allege magic words. We shouldn't have to repeat magic words to be able to keep our case in and allow us access to the courts. So just because we don't have the words facially neutral employment practice doesn't mean it isn't there. And let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so identify what that particular practice is. Is it your position just giving the exam itself?
Well, here's the thing, Judge Williams. We no longer live in a time anymore where there are many of these statutes that allege race on their face. I think we're decades away from that. So I think it's not even a requirement under the Title VII statute that you plead a facially neutral employment practice. These are coming out of summary law cases. But the point here is virtually every statute today is racially neutral.
I've had trouble understanding what your complaint is. These public employees, they were promoted or not promoted according to test results, correct?
That's not entirely the case. Testing is part of it.
Right, testing is part of it. So now, is your argument that the test is racially biased? Is that the problem?
That is only one of them. It's a
Well, no, is that, are you complaining that it is a racially biased test or not?
We are, Judge Posner, but...
But where is the test? We haven't seen the test.
Right, but Judge Posner, if I may, the process is more complicated than that. They are ranked on a list, and they're given composite scores. Part of their score is a result of testing. But then they have something called a candidate profile, where they're given credit for certain attributes. For example, if they have military service,
racially biased or what? What is it? What is the element of racial discrimination here? That's what I can understand.
Well, I'll give you an example.
We haven't seen the test, right?
Right. But again, Judge Posner, it isn't just limited to a test.
No, I understand. But if you have a test and you have whatever you have, some elements of this higher promotion process have to be racially biased in order for you to have a case, right?
Right.
So what is it? Where is it? Is it interviews? Is it the test? What's the bad?
All right.
The bad thing.
I'll do my best to explain. The whole process looks at several aspects of the people who are applying for promotion. Part of the process, as explained in our brief, is there is a written test, there is an oral test where they're interviewed, and then there is a portion which they have no control over. I'll give you an example. If police officers have field training, they may receive a certain amount of points for that. But because there are so few African-American officers who have the opportunity to receive field training, to be in the field training officer program, they are at a competitive disadvantage. Now, what's important to note about all of this is most of the applicants for
the
promotion
process.
So is
your argument that field training should not be given any weight in promotion? Is that the...
No, it isn't that. But
what is it? What is the worst thing that's going on here that we could focus on?
All right. The applicants tend to be within a fraction of a point.
Right.
And the whole process has not been validated to show that it's related to any business necessity. It winds up promoting. That's the essence of disparate impact. Very few African-American police officers are promoted from sergeant to lieutenant or lieutenant to captain, and the same with the firefighters.
Which of the inputs to the total score are you claiming is the culprit for the disparate impact?
There's a writing exercise, and the candidate profile is constructed in a way after the pool is known, so that the points are allocated in such a way so as to disadvantage African Americans. And it doesn't. If you're thinking about this like a test that everyone takes and whoever scores the highest gets promoted, it really isn't like that. What we have is a group of very well-qualified people, but African-Americans wind up not being at the top of the list, but within sometimes hundredths of a point can separate a person who is promoted from a person who is denied promotion.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure that we've, after all these questions, have still got a clear idea of what inputs to the total score are causing the problem here. And we've asked that question in a lot of different ways and still don't have a clear idea. It's not in your complaint or your amended complaint or your proposed second amended complaint. And frankly, nor is any allegation of fact in any of those iterations of the complaint to the effect that this creates a disproportionate impact on minorities as compared to their population in the police department or the fire department in the city of Indianapolis. There's just a conclusory allegation that this creates a disparate impact, and that's a legal conclusion, not an allegation of fact under Iqbal and Twombly. So you've got those two basic problems with the complaint.
Well, I want to beg to differ. I think in the amended complaint it does lay out that there are problems with the written exercise and with what I refer to as the candidate profile, and that the candidate profile is arbitrary. And there has been an admission by the city of Indianapolis, by the person who constructed the test over the years, that the written exercise has a disparate impact on African Americans. So that information is in there, but I think we've gone right over to my basic argument. And Judge, you said we don't have all these elements in there, but I think that is part of the issue today. Do we, in the complaint, need to place the defendant on notice about why they're being sued and give them an opportunity to prepare a defense? Or do we have to meet all of the elements in a cause of action, which is pleading a prima facie case?
The district court did not dismiss your complaint for the most part on that sort of a basis. The district court granted judgment on the pleadings because you were missing some of these required factual allegations to support your disparate impact claim. She let the disparate treatment cases go to summary judgment. So I don't see what the district court did here as importing summary judgment prima facie case standards into a judgment on the pleadings motion. So that argument is not going to get very far. What you need to do is make a positive case for your amended complaint to us. Our review is de novo on that, right? So make a positive case for your amended complaint on your disparate impact claims that got dismissed on judgment on the pleadings.
Well, then my question is where does this requirement come from that we have to show, for example, a facially neutral
You have to tell
practice.
Us what employment practice it is that you're challenging. And that's what we've been trying to get at with our questions. You haven't told us.
You don't necessarily have to have the magic words. We just need some words that tell us what the policy is. That's what we're trying to get at. And so you've generally said there the tests, but you haven't pointed to any, you know, specific area on the test, or there's no testimony relating to that. And so that's why we're a little mystified as to what it is. You say it's a combination of things, but, you know, it's not really spelled out very clearly in your complaint.
Well, Judge Williams said
notice pleading does require you to spell it out so you can put the other side on notice.
Well, that's not what the Supreme Court says, I don't believe. But here's the thing. We have spelled it out. We're saying that the promotion processes. Yes, sir.
Have you seen the test?
I've seen aspects of the test. Yes, sir.
What do you mean aspects of the test? Have you ever had the test in your hand and read it?
Judge Posner, there is a written test.
I know, the written test. Have you ever seen the written test?
Yes, I believe I have.
You believe you have? You don't know?
I have seen one. There are two written tests. One is a writing exercise. One is a written test. I've seen that. One is an oral interview.
Well, an oral interview is not a written test. I'm just asking whether you've read the written test.
Yes.
And is it biased?
That may be the least, the actual written test may be the least biased component.
Okay, what's the most biased component?
The most biased component would be the candidate profile. And on its face, it would be the written exercise. African Americans are doing a lot worse on the written exercise.
And what is the written exercise composed of? Have you seen that?
Yes, ma'am. The written exercise is an actual writing exercise where they're writing a memorandum or something where they're doing a form of communication as opposed to answering questions.
And what is the form of communication on? Is it like what a case report would be or a memo on an investigation? Give us something more.
It could be, depending on the position.
The written ones you've seen where they have to do some writing, what specifically are they asked to write on?
Sometimes it might be writing to someone out in the community. Sometimes it might be assisting with the prosecutor's office. Depending on the type of position, the communication varies. And the person who prepares the test has admitted that over the years that has been shown to be to have a disparate impact against African Americans.
Is that pleaded?
I believe it is pleaded in the amended
So it's spelled out specifically that the kinds of communications that they are asked to write on are communications it's spelled out that those are biased in some way, the type of communications or the impact of them having to take that part of the test.
I believe there is some aspect of that.
Are those meant to be the deadline? Okay, so your time has expired. Okay. We'll give you a time to rebut after we hear from the other side.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Will?
Thank you. May it please the court, this court should affirm the district court's ruling on the city's motion for judgment on the pleadings, the officer's motion to amend the complaint, and the city's motion for summary judgment. Judgment on the pleadings was appropriate in this case because the plaintiffs have failed to identify, plead, or establish a specific facially neutral employment practice.
The facial neutrality is not a requirement of this cause of action. That's just a descriptive term that the cases use to describe what is a disparate impact claim. It's not an element of the cause of action.
Correct.
I know that's how the district court treated it, but that's wrong.
But that's the cornerstone principle of the disparate impact analysis, which is that it's not intentional.
That's a meaningless term. It's not an element of the claim.
The test is, right? If the test, you could still have a disparate impact claim even though the test was biased, right? You could decide, well, I'm not going to go down that road. It's hard to prove. I'm just going to show that there's no good business reason for this test, right? That's perfectly proper. So you don't have to allege that it's a perfectly fine test, right?
Well, it would have to show in some degree.
No, look, don't you understand? If you want to argue disparate impact, all you're saying is whether this test is biased, unbiased, or what. The point is it has this disparate impact, and it's not justified by the fact that, you know, it's really necessary in order to hire proper labor force, right? So there's no need to allege that the test is not racially biased.
I would think that there is a reason, because it would have to show that it's
Go on to something else. Really.
I think the issue with the disparate impact analysis here, though, there's a couple issues that the city would like to point out. And first is that we keep focusing on the pleading standard. And the EEOC charge is really what the court found as the basis, one of the first bases for dismissing the plaintiff's complaint at the pleading stage. And that was because they alleged solely irrational and highly subjective criteria, as you pointed out, as the basis for their claim.
The EEOC would have easily recognized this as a disparate impact complaint based on the four corners of the EEOC complaint.
Correct, and neither did the court, and neither did the city.
The EEOC would have recognized this as a disparate impact claim. The plaintiffs are challenging the promotion criteria, for lack of a better term. We've had some difficulty identifying what aspect of the promotion criteria are the subject of the claim, but it's clearly a claim of disparate impact targeting the promotion criteria in the Indianapolis Police Department and Fire Department.
Correct.
And the EEOC would clearly have understood that. So our focus now is on the complaint, or in this case, the amended complaint.
Well, and in the amended complaint, the allegations, the importance of citing to a specific practice, I think, is key here, because there are several parts to the process. For example, in the IPD process, in the IMPD process, there are three parts. There is the written test, there is the oral test, and then there is the profile, all of which the officers have discussed. And in each of those, it could be that the written is irrational or highly subjective, or the oral is irrationally highly subjective, or the profile is irrational or highly subjective. The plaintiff hasn't identified which.
Why do the plaintiffs have to identify which part of the composite criteria are creating the disparate impact problem?
Because it could be that no one of them is causing a disparate impact
problem. Why isn't
that
a matter for proofs later on?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't that a matter for proofs on summary judgment or at trial?
Because I think it gives the court and it gives the office or the city fair notice of what particular part of the process is in error. And the plaintiffs obviously had an opportunity to do that through discovery. They had an opportunity to amend their complaint after the city filed their motion for judgment on the pleadings. And they had an opportunity to discover. They had an opportunity to amend the deadline. And they did not do so. They did not find a particular portion of the process.
Is the only defect in their complaint, according to you, the failure to allege that the test or the process is racially unbiased?
No, I think there's more to it than that. Obviously, we've raised the EEOC allegation, and we've raised that they have not identified a facially invalid portion of the complaint, or facially invalid.
You keep coming back to that. Is that all there is? It's so irrelevant.
No, I think that there's more to it than that, because the officers keep alleging that there is a disparate impact when they have provided no evidence of disparate impact.
Well, they provided promotion statistics. They've argued that the promotion process lacks a reasonable nexus to job functions and responsibilities. Why isn't that enough to put you on notice?
Well, for example, they argue that the relevant labor force is the Marion County labor force, but Indiana state law says the relevant labor force is the Indianapolis, Marion County, and the surrounding the contiguous counties. So in part, their analysis is legally wrong because they've analyzed it. They provide no source for their allegation that 25% of the 25% of the Marion County labor force is the statistic that the court should use. But even if it did, the court would find that the relevant labor force is actually much broader, and it's the contiguous counties.
Relevant labor force?
Because the police department draws all of its employees from the Marion County area and the contiguous counties. That the contiguous counties have a much less diverse population, so the population statistics that may apply for Marion County don't apply for the contiguous counties. So in an instance like that, the plaintiff's allegations that the sole basis for their disparate impact claim, essentially that the statistics do not line up with the labor force, those don't pass muster either on the face of the amended complaint. And so there are a lot of these claims that the plaintiffs have stated in their amended complaint that do not survive judgment on the pleadings. And certainly they were given an opportunity to present evidence to develop those claims and flesh them out more, and they weren't able to do so. In fact, they just waited for the court to grant judgment on the pleadings.
Well, are you saying that because of this statistical – well, it's not a statistical error, but the error in having an under-inclusive labor force, does this error – show, when it's corrected, means that there is no disparate impact?
I believe it would, yes, Judge. The court would have to refer to the statistics, the census statistics from the Indianapolis and the contiguous counties.
Well, what is the percentage of blacks in Marion County, and what is the percentage in the larger area, which the real catchment area for this hiring?
I would preface this by saying I don't have it in front of me, but my understanding is that it is approximately 20 to 25% in Marion County. But when you factor in the contiguous counties from which the employment labor force is drawn, it drops to about 12 to 13%.
Now you agreed with Judge Sykes that based on the EEOC complaint, the EEOC could have investigated both disparate impact and disparate treatment. If we were to find that the disparate impact claims were within the scope of the EEOC charges, doesn't that mean that the disparate impact was properly pled in the complaint?
Respectfully, no. First, I don't know that it would be fair to characterize my comments as agreement. Again, we would still maintain that the statement of irrational and subjective criteria is insufficient to identify the specific practice that was causing a disparate impact. And again, that goes back to the fact that, for example, referring to the IMPD process from 2008, plaintiffs Walton and Coleman took the exam. They finished 16th and 17th. If one of those plaintiffs did worse on the exam, on the oral part of the exam, and another part plaintiff did worse on the written part of the exam, then we're not talking about one policy that's having an adverse impact. We're talking about multiple policies that are, for some reason, creating an impact that is lowering scores. That overall, there's no rational connection between one person doing more poorly on the written exam and another person doing more poorly on the oral exam. So I would not characterize my
statement. Is there any evidence about how other fire departments determine promotions? Is this something that Indianapolis thought up all by itself, or is this what everybody does? Or
oh, you mean as far as how is the promotional process itself created?
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that is in the record, but it was created by the Indianapolis Public Safety Partners, which is a group that does a lot of law enforcement in the state of Indiana.
In what?
In the state of Indiana. They do a lot of public safety promotional processes for other departments as well.
It's still not limited. It's not just Marion County.
Correct.
Then on this writing portion of the exam, can you speak to that? Because counsel suggests that is an area where the minorities were scoring lower just generally. I mean, is that what the evidence has shown?
I don't think that's what the evidence has shown. Plaintiff's counsel obviously stated that it was the least discriminatory part of the test.
No. I'm talking about the writing, the portion where he said they were asked if there was a citizen that they had to correspond with the correspondence section. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the scores on the assessment section, so I can't answer that, Judge. I apologize. But my understanding is the assessment was part of the overall written score, and the IMPD broke it into written and written assessment, oral, and then the profile, which is simply an assignment of points to an officer's experience within the department.
But all those things go into the total composite score, right?
Correct.
And so why isn't it enough for the plaintiff to plead a challenge to the total method that the police department and the fire department use for promotion in all of its myriad parts and leave the specifics for summary judgment? I think that's what the plaintiff's argument is, that all they have to do is attack the method that the police department and fire department use for promotions in overall terms in the complaint and can flesh everything else out in discovery.
I think you're talking about the pleading stage, not at the summary judgment stage, obviously.
Well, right, because what we have is judgment on the pleadings, on the disparate impact
right.
claim.
I think it is important for the plaintiff to put on notice. See, they're essentially giving us the recitation of what they believe a disparate impact claim is. They're essentially reciting the elements of the claim, which the Supreme Court said in Iqbal is not enough. You need to provide some evidence.
What,
that makes
what
it possible.
More? Well, you shouldn't talk about evidence in terms of a complaint. What more should they allege? Should they have alleged in the complaint?
Well, they certainly, and I'd like to compare it. Maybe it would be best to compare it to the Twombly case, where the court found
not
that there
the
were
not the Twombly case. No, just what should they have? What should they have put in?
Well, particularly, I think that they should have included evidence of a particular practice by the city, a particular
portion
of the exam.
You mean evidence. You mean an allegation. Okay, what should they have alleged?
Well, the officers certainly, when they receive their scores, would know how they did on the written score, how they did on the oral score, and how they did on the profile score. So they could have alleged the written score has, the written examination does have a disparate impact. And that would be in compliance, I think, with
the written examination has what?
If they could allege that the written score is the part of the test that's having a disparate impact or is causing.
Well, I don't know why it matters what part of it is. Why does that matter? What do they have to show to. I mean, that's like saying they have to pick out the question that was bad on the test, right?
No, I don't think it's that.
Why can't they just allege that this promotion system with its various components has a disparate impact? And presumably, you know, to satisfy Iqbal, they shouldn't just say that. They should have some statistics, you know. X percent of blacks are promoted. And then if you look at the population from which these people are recruited or the junior firemen and so on, you see it's disparate. And then the test, you allege, isn't really necessary. Other fire departments do it very differently, something of that sort. Would that suffice?
That would certainly provide more factual material than is provided here. I don't know the answer to that question because I don't know that.
Answer to the question, where does that leave you with your case? So I've given, I mean, this. I don't know if this is what I'm saying is an approximation to the actual complainant's case, but I'm not sure what more is necessary in a disparate impact. You know, enough to make it seem as if, yeah, there may be a problem here, maybe the test really isn't necessary and it really does have a disparate impact. Why is that enough?
Well, I think there are a couple of things here that the plainest facts that have drawn away from that, and particularly with regard to the allegation of the subjectivity of the test, I like to make the point that the subject nature of the test implies that this test itself is being applied in a discriminatory manner. If
now,
the test is irrational
issue.
And highly subjective.
Also, I think you're talking. Now, you know, with the system we have in this court, you have to glance occasionally over at the clerk's desk to see what your time is. So what does that mean now? Pardon? Okay, so the card that's in front is the current. Okay, so what you have one now. Okay.
So irrational, highly subjective allegation is indicative of that it's subjective, and that it implies disparate treatment. And in this circumstance, the disparate treatment.
Subjectivity is not a requirement of disparate impact. All you need for disparate impact is they're giving you. I mean, what if they were giving you a test in your knowledge of Greek, and it would be perfectly objective test graded by Greek speakers, but it wouldn't have anything to do with being a fireman in Indianapolis, right?
Certainly.
So the fact that it had a disparate impact wouldn't be justifiable, right? You wouldn't need more than that. You wouldn't have to talk about subjectivity.
Well, in that circumstance, I would agree with you. But I think in this circumstance, there's no allegations, I should say, that the test was not reasonably related
to
public.
What's missing? That there's no allegation that this test really is not necessary or, you know, justifiable by business necessity, some term of that sort to suggest that even if it has a disparate impact, it may be okay. Is that what's missing?
Correct, because what's going on here is that it's not a test about Greek. It's a test about public safety officers and what they do in their jobs. And there's been no allegation that that's not the source of the test and that's not the subject of the test. They just claim that it's irrational.
But isn't business justification a defense?
It is.
Well, you usually don't have to plead defenses in your complaint, right? That's for the answer.
Correct.
So why isn't it enough just to plead that there is a disparate impact and then shift to the defendant the burden of pleading necessity?
And again, because I come back to it, but I think it's the insignificance of the individual portions of the test and how each one of those significant or different portions of the test could have a different impact on the test taker. And so there's no way to remedy necessarily one officer doing worse on the written exam, whereas another officer does worse on the oral exam. There's absolutely no way to resolve that issue and show that it has a disparate impact. The written portion, and I think that complies with the Supreme Court's case law, for example, the discussion in Lewis talked about particular groupings on the exam to create well-qualified and qualified. It was a particular practice that the city could address and discuss. Similarly, with, I believe, the City of New York case discussed by the plaintiffs in their brief, there was an arbitrary cutoff, again, a particular practice that was at issue. That was alleged by the plaintiffs. In this case, the plaintiffs have just said, the whole system's wrong. Let's go forward and prove it. And they've given us no indication that it was the written, the oral, or the profile, okay. Or in the officer's cases, the practical.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Will. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Gadsden, I think his time expired, but we'll give you another minute if you have anything further you'd like to say.
Thank you, Judge Posner, Judge Sykes, and Judge Wims. I want to address a couple of things, if I could. One has to do with amending the complaint. We're already up to 48 pages in the amended complaint, and I think it's absurd that that's where our jurisprudence is going. I can make it 100 pages, too, if we need all those facts in there, but I don't think judges would appreciate that. And it wouldn't fit within the requirement, the policy of notice pleading. So we did ask the judge to amend the complaint, but we think, and your own jurisprudence says, that a plaintiff should ordinarily be given, automatically be given a right to amend the complaint.
At the time, in the case management plan had long since expired when you came in with that request.
Ma'am, the motion was made 5 months before the deadline expired. And the case law, the Seventh Circuit jurisprudence says we have a right to see if the court finds a deficiency.
Your motion to amend the complaint was made before the deadline expired?
No, it wasn't. But the court took almost 1 year to rule on the motion for judgment.
I understand that there was a transfer of judges and so forth.
That wasn't the reason why. That would have explained.
That took some of the time.
Yes.
But in any event, the deadline expired in the spring and.
Yes.
The motion wasn't made until after the motion for judgment on the pleadings had been granted.
That's right.
You could have sought, before the deadline expired, you could have sought an extension to await the judge's decision on the motion for judgment on the pleadings.
Right, but
and
so then,
didn't do that.
No, but that's a form of gotcha jurisprudence to say that you have to ask for permission when your cases clearly say, see, the defendant shouldn't be allowed to be a puppeteer under the system and everybody shouldn't be its puppet. But just because the defendant says the complaint is deficient doesn't mean it is so. We should have the right to have the court declare that it's deficient. And if the court says so, then we should seek to amend it. We don't know ahead of time whether the court will agree with the defendant.
What would you have put in the complaint?
There are no reason that you couldn't have filed for the extension while that motion was pending, while the court had it under consideration. There was no reason that you could not have filed for the extension.
There was no hindrance, but I don't know any requirement in the rules that we need to do so. And I would just say it's incompatible with your own Seventh Circuit jurisprudence. It says that a plaintiff is entitled to wait and see if there are pleading deficiencies as declared by the court.
Did your second amended complaint, the proposed Second Amendment complaint, address this issue of which particular employment practice was being challenged and also whether there was any statistical factual support for a disparate impact claim?
Those
are the two deficiencies that we've been discussing here today.
Yes, ma'am, I believe we did. In fact, they focused most of their energy on the fact that we hadn't declared or identified a facially neutral.
I know, we've disposed of that already. If you could answer my question, what in your proposed Second Amendment complaint identified the particular employment practice that was being challenged, and were there any factual allegations to support a statistical disparity?
Well, the problem, again, is it's a very complex.
So your answer is no.
No, it's not no. It means that the whole process had problems with disparate impact.
That's a no answer. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Gadsden and Mr. Will. And we'll move on to our next case, United States versus Larinetta. Mr. Prasad. Ms. Prasad, sorry. Why don't you wait a second until it quiets down? We won't start the clock running until it does.